Did Seba just walk out? Seba just walk out the door?
I don't know. She may have. I'll go get her.
Well, yeah.
I hadn't got that
actually. Yes, I figure. Good time to do that.
Okay. Rolling? Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, March 15, 2010. We have a quorum. We have a number of bills on the agenda. The first bill is Senate File 2629, Senator Seben's bill on county assisted voting, vote getting, vote counting, and optical scan equipment grants appropriation. Senator Seben, welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Members, Senate File 2629 is an election bill that appropriates some money that came from the Help America Vote Act account. Some of this remaining money, it redistributes to, or it distributes to counties across the state. And with me today to help explain it is Kevin Corbid from Washington County.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and Commissioners, I'm Kevin Corbid, the Director of Property Records and Taxpayer Services for Washington County. I also serve as a legislative chair for the County Auditor and Treasurer Group, but today I'm speaking in my capacity with Washington County. In 2005, the Minnesota Legislature passed a bill to spend $35 million in federal Help America Vote Act funds to acquire assistive voting machines and to purchase precinct-based voters in precinct-based vote counters in Minnesota. $29 million of that money was shared amongst the 87 counties based on the number of polling places in each county. The remaining $6 million was made available to counties if the first allocation to their county did not pay the full cost of purchasing the vote count equipment. The federal money paid the full cost of one assistive voting piece of equipment per precinct, which is called the AutoMark. You may have seen it in use in your precincts over the last couple of years. And in counties where they were replacing central count machines or going from hand-counting ballots to precinct-based counters, it also paid the full cost of the purchase of those vote counters. In some cases, counties also had money left over from the original appropriation to help offset some of the new operation and maintenance costs for this new election equipment. Out of that original $35 million, nearly $33 million was allocated and sent to the counties. As of today, about $2.5 million in federal money that was identified to help counties purchase equipment remains in the state HAVA account. This bill asks that the remaining money be allocated to the counties as follows. First, $300,000 be available to rural counties with under 50,000 in population to help pay for additional operation and maintenance costs if they have exhausted or nearly exhausted their funds from 2005. This section allows grants to be made for the upcoming 2010 and 2012 elections if funds remain available. 70 of the 87 counties in Minnesota have populations under that $50,000 threshold. Secondly, the bill appropriates $2.1 million in these federal funds to help fund the replacement of precinct counters in those counties who did not get any assistance with state or federal funding when that equipment was purchased, when that equipment they are replacing was purchased. Counties that purchased equipment prior to the end of 2002 and did not get any financial assistance and that are purchasing prior to 2014 would be eligible for a grant. The grants can be for up to $4,000 per polling place, but may be less if grant requests exceed the appropriation available. This federal funding would assist those counties and cities that used only property tax funds to purchase the equipment prior to any state or federal funding becoming available. A local match is required of 50% by the county receiving the grant. In my role with the County Auditor Treasurer's Group, I have made all 87 counties aware of this funding proposal numerous times over the last 2 years, and have asked counties that are concerned to raise those. There was some feedback on how to make the operating grants in Section 1 work better, and those suggestions were incorporated into Senator Seben's bill before it was introduced. But other than that, there seems to be an understanding that the counties that purchase without any state or federal funding should get assistance with their replacement purchase. Those counties that purchased new equipment with the federal money in 2005 and 6 were able to do so with no local share. With that, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd answer any questions that you might have.
And I do need to double check with the Secretary of State's office if they're here. I mean, this is an appropriation of $2.4 million for fiscal year 11. But this is money that's currently in the HAVA account then, so this is not new money that would be coming up with Ms. Fraser, is this a new appropriation or is this existing funds?
Mr. Chair, Beth Fraser with Office of the Secretary of State. These are funds that are already segregated within the HAVA account, earmarked for the counties. They're just changing how they can use it.
Okay, so this is not a new appropriation. We're just transferring money from the HAVA account into here.
Mr. Chair, we're keeping it in a segregated account and just saying instead of it can be used for these things, it can be used for these other things.
Okay, so it's still HAVA money within the HAVA account. Gotcha. Okay, we're just appropriating money out of that account. Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I do have the A2 amendment, too.
Oh, okay.
This is language that was just kind of cleanup language, actually.
Okay.
And this is the first stop of the bill.
Right, yes. It was referred to the Finance Committee, so this is the first stop. So let's get the amendment distributed.
I'll introduce.
Okay. Everybody got it. Okay, Senator Olson moves the A2 amendment, which is an author's amendment, to put the bill in the shape that the author's desires to proceed. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. And the A2 amendment does what then, so?
Mr. Chair, it's language that the Secretary of State's office recommended just for changing some of the different ways to describe some of the words that were used in the bill. So essentially, it's just reworking the language slightly, but it's not changing anything substantially from the way the bill was introduced or the way the bill is just described.
Okay, it looks like the main part is on lines 1.8 to 1.12 where the counties can apply for $4,000 per precinct, replace optical scan voting equipment, and they have to agree to pay 50% match. Okay.
Right. And Mr. Chair, that language was already in the bill as introduced. Just change the language.
Gotcha. Okay. Is there anybody else here who wants to be heard on Senate File 2629? Sarah Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if they aren't ready to purchase, because this is a replacement program, right? Can they hold the funds? Are we letting them keep it for a while until they are in need of these replacement scanners?
Ms. Corbett?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we are, the mechanics of the bill says that a county that wants to get a grant under this proposal has to have their grants in by December of this year, of 2010. And the Secretary of State's office will take all those grants for qualifying counties and make the grants out to those counties. We have to know how many precincts want the money before we can split it up in case it exceeds that $4,000 per precinct. And so we're allowing the grants to be made to the counties that are about to purchase or replace before 2014. And the counties will keep it in our HAVA accounts, which we're required to have set up. And then that money will be used to buy the election equipment. There's no way for money that goes to the counties to be kept in any kind of a general fund used for general purposes. It must be used for the election equipment.
Any other questions? Okay, is there a motion?
I'll move it.
Okay, Sarah Roebling moves that Senate File 2629 as amended be recommended to pass to the Finance Committee. Discussion of the motion. Hearing none, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevail. Thank you, Senator Seaman.
Mr. Chair.
I see Senator Dahl came in. Since he's not in the Budget Division, let's move to that bill then. Senator Dahl, Senate File 2915, Fiscal Note Requirements Modification. Welcome to the Budget Division, Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair and committee, and bill across the hall coming up too, so I'm flying by the seat of my pants here today. The bill that you have is really just trying to get a little bit more information regarding fiscal notes, and I know how difficult it is to get a fiscal note at times in a timely manner. It's not my goal to slow up the process, but I just think it's important to take a more holistic approach in terms of the real costs to the state and beyond the state budget. So the bill is fairly self-explanatory here. As you can see, it's amended to read, the fiscal note, where possible, shall also, and I, you can see the underlined additions there, cite the net increase or decrease in total number of jobs in the state, cite the net increase or decrease in the number of jobs held by Minnesota residents, estimate the average annual wages of jobs impacted, line 114, estimate the effect on federal funds and any federal requirements, including but not limited to maintenance of effort requirements and state loan repayment obligations associated with borrowing from federal funds. So this bill is written by a colleague of mine in the House, and he asked that I carry it in the Senate, and I have no one to speak with me. I'm the lone person here today. So I'll stand for any questions.
And I'm looking through the assumptions on the fiscal note. It doesn't show, the fiscal note itself doesn't show an impact, but it does say that it does go beyond. It refers to some of the time constraints and so forth. Is there anybody from MMB or anybody who's here to comment on this? Welcome to the Budget Division, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dennis Munkwitz from Minnesota Management and Budget. Okay.
By the way, Mr. Chair, I don't know if this fiscal note has a fiscal note.
Well, it doesn't show any numbers on it. It was prepared by Mr. Munkwitz, and I'm just kind of interested in what this would mean to the process of producing fiscal notes. Ms. Munkwitz?
Mr. Chair and members, in preparing the note, we took some of the assumptions that I talked about in the note. We assumed that some of the information may be readily available to agencies. We're not sure of the reliability of the information, should we be able to get it, because we're really talking about effects on jobs that are outside of state government, is, I believe, what your intent is. We prepare fiscal notes to talk about what the impacts are to the state of Minnesota. So when we talk about costs, we're usually talking about FTEs to implement new services or program changes, et cetera. So we think that because the language is permissive, that if we can get the data, we certainly would provide it in the fiscal notes, but we're not sure that we'll be able to collect the data.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Sarah Roebling.
I can kind of understand that some of it might be really hard to find, especially the one cite the net increase or decrease in the number of jobs held by Minnesota residents. It really is going to be an estimate.
Mm-hmm.
I can see where that could be very difficult one to attain. I don't know how do we hold them to it if they don't give us an accurate number, or it proves to be inaccurate, but how are they supposed to arrive at that one in particular?
Yeah, that seems a little more nebulous. I mean, we do see fiscal notes that estimate how many full-time equivalent positions are going to be needed to create a position. So, I mean, when we're talking about, state agencies, I mean, that gives the information we already have about the number of jobs that would be created in order to do the task. But I'm trying to identify who would get those jobs. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, I'm sure we have people who work for the state who happen to live across the border of Wisconsin. They just commute. I don't know. So, Senator Dowell, what would be so critical about the number of jobs held by Minnesota residents, and how do you have any idea how that information could be gleaned? I mean, I think that'd be kind of difficult to ascertain, when we're just passing a bill.
Mr. Chair, and I agree, there are some hurdles that this bill or this particular language might cause to the Department of Management and Budget. I think it does. I think what I'm hearing, however, there may be some. We have enough leeway in the language that it may be something that they could speculate on, and I don't know exactly how far they're allowed to speculate or even infer possible budget bills, but I think it's something that may be worth the discussion. I understand your concerns.
Well, you know, if it's, I mean, it's permissive, but if all we're going to get are fiscal notes that just say, you know, we don't know, and that's all we're ever going to get. And I mean, as I say, the number of jobs, we kind of get something of that on the ones that apply to state agencies, because it tells us how many full-time people we're going to need to implement something. So that information is sort of already available. The estimated wages, I suppose you could talk about whether we're having, you know, high-level jobs or low-level jobs or whatever, but as I say, I'm just not sure how they would ever implement 9 to 10. I mean, you know, if it passes, is it ever going to be meaningful, and is it ever going to show up in any fiscal note? That's, you know, I mean, I just have some concerns about passing something that is never going to happen, so. Any thoughts? Sir Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl are the gentlemen from MMB. Do fiscal notes, do they have since all of this is permissive, at least in paragraph A, paragraph B is not permissive, but A is, do they have these other items in there? I mean, do they routinely do these other things?
You're
curious.
Yeah, you're asking, well, it says, the current law says where possible.
The whole section is discretionary, mm-hmm. So do they do numbers, what are now 1, 5, 6, 8, 9, and 10?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, yes. Those are categories that are built into every fiscal note, so yes.
Mr. Berkowitz, do you see any problems in the other? I mean, we've kind of discussed the ones about the jobs held by Minnesota residents, but the total jobs in the state, I mean, is that something that's covered currently by the full-time equivalent?
Mr. Chair and members, no, that
no.
Isn't.
Okay.
And I don't know where we would get that data, you know. When I was writing this fiscal note, I thought, what kind of bill would I see this information that would be good if we could provide it on? And I wasn't sure that I could come up with something.
Okay.
I could think about the omnibus spending bills, the capital projects bill. We don't do fiscal notes on those types of bills. You know, those would be bills that the capital budgets, we had a discussion in here last week about tracking jobs that are created or retained as a result of the capital budget bill. But I just couldn't come up with a good example of a bill that would seek this data. And I'm sure that they're out there. I just couldn't think of an example that I thought that would be helpful in my thinking in preparing the notes, but I couldn't come up with anything like that.
Senator Rush?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I find number 7 really interesting. And I think that would be useful information, and maybe information that would not be so difficult to obtain. But how do we go about borrowing? I mean, this is for the fiscal analyst. When do we borrow from federal funds? On what occasions? Is that a phenomenon that's pretty common? Or, I mean, do we do like they do with some of the transportation funds, where we anticipate money coming,
I think that's referring to the student loan repayment obligations associated with borrowing from federal funds.
It doesn't say that though.
How about unemployment?
Does it? The state
7.
Loan repayment obligation.
Maintenance of effort requirements and state loan repayment obligations associated with borrowing from federal funds.
When do we do that, Senator Dahl?
I don't think we know from at this end. Mr. Muckwitz, does that make any sense to you? About what
Mr. Chair and members, the only time that I could think of that we might do that, I don't, is the unemployment insurance fund at Deed? Maybe don't they do some borrowing from the feds at some points? That's
I'm asking.
That's the only area that I could think of.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this is pretty doable. In the bonding area, we often ask MinSCU and the University of Minnesota to do a projection for us on how many jobs they think will be, created as a result of the bonding bill. And, you know, it may not be, it's not that difficult to do because there's kind of a rule of thumb in some case. MinSCU gave me a pretty broad number, but the university actually did a whole report where they talked about direct jobs. They had an economist do it, and they talked about direct jobs and indirect jobs. So, you know, I think consulting with the state economists that this should be very doable.
But
the only problem I see is that I don't know if they can break it down by Minnesota residents and non-Minnesota residents. That might be a I've not seen that before. It's a good question, though, because it could be that they're bringing in out-of-state contractors and out-of-state workers. But I hadn't really heard that being, you know, a huge problem.
But we just had a bill in the term. Who had the bill? We asked for that very information from the bonding bill.
Terry Bond.
Yeah, well, right. And so, I mean, that's an appropriate question for the bonding bill. I mean, but do we need that information for the fiscal notes as opposed to the bonding bill? I mean, you know, if you know, we could require that of the bonding bill, but this doesn't deal with that. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, I think that then you, instead of saying where possible, you might say where appropriate. Because in some cases, like, you know, with Job Z Zone, you might want to know how many jobs are going to be created. And in other cases, if we're increasing funding for child care or something, then it might not be appropriate.
Well, the current law says where possible, and I'd be very hesitant to go on in and try to, you know, change that part, because that's how all of our fiscal notes are based upon current law.
Okay.
So,
well, and they would say it's not appropriate if it's not appropriate,
yeah,
too.
Well, anybody else want to be heard of the bill? What's the...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the opportunity for you to hear the bill. And,
sure.
And again, I'm not an expert on fiscal notes. I would hope that these are the things that we always consider when we talk about budgets and how we spend money and how we cut budgets. But, again, I am aware of some of the limitations that might be present.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then the other concern, I think, was that maybe we don't need that language on 115 and 116 because we're not quite sure if it's applicable or not. State loan repayment obligations associated with borrowing from federal funds. I don't think that would injure your bill too much. Do you think, Senator Dahl, if we deleted that?
If anything stayed in this bill, that would be fine. I mean, it's
well.
And Mr. Chairman, why don't we move on line 1.15 to delete and state loan repayment obligations, and then delete on 1.16 up to the semicolon.
Does that work? Let's see.
And after the comment.
Does that everybody think that's a good idea?
Mr. Browder, what do we need to do here?
Mr. Chairman, I thought we needed to supply, since we're deleting the second or the first and on line 15, we need to move that somewhere else, but I think that it'll read fine without that.
Right, just so Senator Pappas is moving on page 1, line 15, strike everything after the word requirements through the end of the line, strike 1.16 up through the semicolon. Discussion of that motion. Hearing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Send a rest.
Mr. Chairman, I like number two, but I really do think number three is just
speculative.
Too difficult to ask anybody to even estimate, and I would move to strike that one.
Okay, Senator Rest moves to delete lines 1.9 and 1.10.
And the rest of it I think would be okay.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what our other motions are. But Senator Rust moves to delete lines 1.9 and 1.10. Discussion of that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Okay. Any further discussion or anything else?
Mr.
Chair? Senator Olsen.
Would it be appropriate to lay this bill over for possibly working it in with Senator Bonoff's bill?
Where is her bill?
Well, Senator, let's see. Senator Bonoff's bill was laid over. Wasn't it laid over because of the cost? So I don't know that we're going to get back to Senator Bonoff's bill until she could figure out how to pay for it. This has no fiscal note cost to it, so.
And we're stripping it down, so it's pretty much doable.
Yeah, but seems doable.
Yeah. Right. It does.
Right. Okay, appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill as amended.
Okay. Let me just double check here. Okay, Senator Rust moves that Senate File 2915 as amended be recommended pass the Finance Committee. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dahl.
Thank you very much, Chair and Committee.
Okay, Senator Rest, Senate File 2870, Legislative Auditor Audit Cost Payment Authorization from Heritage Fund Appropriations.
Chairman, Senate File 2870 proposes a way to pay for the financial audits that the Legislative Auditor's Office has to conduct with regard to the various funds that were established through the sales tax amendment that was passed last fall, so that those costs are not borne by the general fund, but by the funds, the four separate funds themselves. And the fiscal note shows how that is broken up between the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, and the Parks and Trail Fund.
Okay, and
straightforward, Mr.
Right, Mr. Nobles, do you have anything to add?
If you have any questions.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, we do have added audit responsibility because of the legacy amendment, and there are the four funds. We plan on starting to do audit work in 2011. There is law that was passed by the legislature that requires us to audit the Outdoor Heritage Fund every other year. And we would try to keep on that same schedule for the other funds as well. So we would group two of the four funds together each year and audit them and then rotate every other year. And again, this approach would not provide us with a general fund appropriation to do this. So at least for the first year, we will be doing that out of our existing resources and then having the funds that we audit reimburse the general fund. So. And this is going to be a 25-year obligation, as you know. So it's going to be an ongoing responsibility of the office.
And normally, Mr. Nobles, you do charge the respective agencies for the audit. I mean, so they you get paid for some of that, yeah?
Mr. Chairman, most of our audit work is done out of our general fund appropriation.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
We do currently charge three organizations for our audit work. We bill them, and we have billing rates based on our the hourly rates of our audit staff. But that money currently does not go into our account. It goes back into the general fund.
Right. We had that discussion that you don't want to have that conflict of having a charge for the, you know. But one question I've got, and maybe Mr. Bodden, you can respond to this. Do we have that flexibility within the constitutional amendment that was passed to be able to use those funds for audit purposes, or are they strictly dedicated to those outdoor heritage, arts, et cetera, that the constitutional amendment specified? Or do we know?
Mr. Chairman, I took a look at that quite a while ago, but mm-hmm. I seem to recall it was there may even be precedent elsewhere. I think it's
okay.
Doable, but I defer to anything Mr. Nobles has to add.
Sure.
To
that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe that within the budgets of those funds, there are line items for administering the fund, and I would consider conducting a financial audit part of the administrative costs mm-hmm. for the audit. And as a matter of fact, I believe they're quite generous.
Okay. I just want to make sure everything wasn't dedicated. Like the federal stimulus funds, as I recall, were sent to us with no flexibility on using any of that money for audits. And so I just want to, but there'll be time between now and the Finance Committee, just make sure that that's clean line. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rester, Mr. Nobles, how are these financially administered now? Is it through the LCC or do they set up separate organizations?
It's a separate organization, I think, Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, the money resides, obviously, in the Treasury, and then it has to receive an appropriation from the legislature. Most of the money, as we're tracking it now, is being sent to a state agency, the Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, the Arts Board, various of the state agencies. But then a lot of that money is then being sent to a nonprofit organization. And so it sometimes is being administered. I may not be getting to...
No, Mr. Chairman, you missed my question. They all have executive directors and they all have expenses, per diem or whatever. I mean, what's the fiscal agent for them, for these funds?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and again, Senator Pappas, I think you're referring to the Lessard Commission arrangement for the Outdoor Heritage Fund. There are not comparable organizations for the other three funds.
Oh, I see.
Even though the Lessard Council, Lessard Sam's Council, has some initial review, obviously, like the LCCMR, they are not actually the administrative agent for that money.
Who is?
Well, it's many different organizations. Some of that money could go to DNR, for example.
I understand that. Mr. Chairman, I'm really sorry, but the Lessard Council has an executive director, right? So who pays his salary?
But, Mr. Chairman,
somehow I'm missing
the Lessard Council is actually in the legislative branch, so it can't be the executive branch administrative agency for administering those funds once that money is appropriated by the legislature and is expended for projects. The role of the Lessard Council, and indeed it does have an executive director who is paid and other people out of that through the Outdoor Heritage Fund money, if that's what you're getting at, yes, that part of the whole function of utilizing the legacy fund, specifically the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the fund pays for the legislative review process, if you want to look at it that way. The per diems, the executive director's salary.
Who authorizes?
The legislature does. Appropriates that money for the Lessard Council. But once that bill comes to you, and it was just before...
So the Lessard Council then is not like a nonprofit organization that gets the money?
No, Mr. Chairman.
It's the executive branch.
It's a legislative commission.
It's a legislative commission.
Well, that's correct.
So they have their own infrastructure.
Who decides how much the salary for the executive director is going to be? That would be, you know, what authority?
So are they like the legislative commission on pensions, for example?
Okay.
Mr. Hubinger is here. It's actually under the legislative coordinating commission.
That's what I was trying to get at. It's under the LCC. That was the answer to my question. All right. Thank you. It was a simple answer. I just wanted to know who was in charge.
Is that telepathic or what?
Mr. Chairman, if I could also go back to your...
Much more complicated.
Could go back to your question on the constitutionality. This question did come up at the Legislative Audit Commission, and Representative Hansen had Mark Shepard at House Research prepare a legal analysis of that question. I'd be happy to make that available. Okay. Members of the committee and specifically to your legal counsel. Obviously, Senate counsel may want to do some additional research, but it really gets to the point that I think Senator Ress made, that the legislature has already appropriated money from the constitutional amendment funds to fund a variety of administrative functions. One of them, back to Senator Pappas's question, is the Lessard Council but other administrative functions as well. So I will make this available to you.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm more comfortable with the arrangement that now that I know it's part of the LCC, because I know Mr. Hubinger does a really good job in keeping a handle on all that. So.
But Mr. Chairman, I would just add that our audit work, of course, which is what this bill is about, will be to go out into the various organizations, both government agencies and nonprofit organizations, that ultimately receive the money to do a wide range of things in terms of the environment, natural resources, arts, culture. That's where we will be conducting our audit work.
Mr. Chairman, it is trying to establish a paper trail for the grants that are given, that they are being used in the way in which and for the purposes for which the money has gone out to the organization.
Senator Roble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Reste, I appreciate the bill, even though some of the advocates might say that that wasn't the intended purpose, was to pay for audits. I think that very few would disagree that they want to see accountability, and they want to make sure that all the rest of the money goes for its intended purposes and isn't being frittered away by some group that got a grant or money that was passed through and not being appropriately used. So I think it's important to do this, and it's important to have the funding for them to take on that responsibility.
So now, who decides the billing rates then? I mean, establishes that?
Mr. Chairman, we establish our billing rates. They're used in part as a part of the indirect cost allocation system. They're available to anybody that wants to review them. I have them here. If your committee staff could certainly review them as well. I might just add to the point about the expectation of these funds being used for not only audits but other administrative functions. As you know, Mr. Chairman and members, we have a variety of dedicated accounts, both constitutional and statutory dedicated accounts, and we do typically use the indirect cost allocation system to reimburse the general fund, and that is the system that is used now, for example, when we do work at the Department of Transportation. The Trunk Highway Fund reimburses the general fund for that audit work. For our office, the Attorney General, and a variety of other state government functions. That's also true in Game and Fish Fund and a variety of other funds. Federal funds as well reimburse for this kind of work. So I don't think there would really be a precedent for accepting these funds that are a part of the legacy amendment.
Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 2870? Any further discussion, Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 2870 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rust. The other bill that we have on the agenda is a bill that I introduced on behalf of the administration. It's Senate File 3134. That is the governor's recommendations for the state government budget area. Now, of course, we've already made our recommendations, and it's already been incorporated into the finance bill. However, there are some provisions within this bill that are policy related, and so we wanted to give the administration an opportunity to go through the governor's recommendations to see just what is in this bill and what needs to be done here. So I believe Ms. Reed here, and welcome back to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Abigail Reed. I'm an Executive Budget Officer at Minnesota Management and Budget.
Mr. Chair, members, Catherine Barondo. I'm also a Budget Officer with MMB.
Okay, go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, as you said, the first article of the bill actually implements the governor's budget recommendations that we discussed earlier. So we would focus our testimony today on Article 2 and the language from there to the remainder of the bill.
Yeah, we went through the spreadsheet when we didn't have the bill, but we had the spreadsheet, so we had the governor's supplemental budget recommendations in here, so we know what was recommended as opposed to this. So that's Article 1 that we've already kind of got an idea of. So, okay, go ahead with Article 2 then, which starts on page 8.
Mr. Chair, starting on line 8.8, mm-hmm. The first section modifies the existing statute that determines what happens when we have expenses for a governor-elect. And I believe the existing statute was actually put in a few years ago, probably 2006, and was the beginning of a response to the last time we had a governor-elect and what happened then. The Management Analysis Division, MAD, which is now part of our agency, made some recommendations on how to improve the statute following a legislative auditor report on the process. So this just continues making improvements to that statute, getting it ready for the next time we would use it.
Okay.
So basically what it does is converts the existing transfer language to a flat amount. So previously the statute said that the Commissioner of Administration could request a transfer equal to 1.5% of the amount appropriated to the Office of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor. What this would do is switch the Commissioner to Management and Budget, reflecting that MAD has now moved to our agency, and then convert that transfer to a flat amount of $162,000. And that amount reflects an estimate done by the agency on what the transition costs would likely be.
Okay.
And it does retain the existing review by the Legislative Advisory Commission. It also does, as I said, make some clarifications of roles and kinds of expenses expected based on MAD's analysis.
Senator Rust.
Oh, never mind. I see where the answer to my question is.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
And lastly, the Subdivision 3 does make some explanation of what happens if they're unused funds and puts a time frame on the use of the funds. So if there are no questions on that one,
okay, go ahead.
I'd move to Section 2, which starts on line 9.10. And this is just a clarification of existing law governing the permanent school fund. This is a fund where proceeds from trust lands, things like timber sales and mineral rights, are then collected. The earnings on that fund are then certified and twice a year transferred to the Department of Education, where they are distributed to schools. And so what this does is just clarify existing practice, which is that the interest earned on the amount as it's sitting in the state treasury, essentially, is included as the total amount of the earnings before certifying for distribution. So it's just a clarification of current practice. And if there are no questions on that item, Sections 3 and 9 amend new appropriations that came through this budget division last year. They were the appropriations to pay the debt service on the lease purchase financing for the integrated tax system and the MAPS replacement system, now called SWIFT. And so last year, when we had the appropriations before you, they were based on an estimate of the interest rate, which was 5%. Once we actually completed the lease purchase agreements, the interest rate came in at 2.8817, I'm told, by Treasury Division. And so we needed to go in and modify the appropriations to match. And the reason we have appropriations actually spelled out in law for this kind of debt service is it's not a general obligation of the state, so there's not an open appropriation for that debt service. We did need the amounts specified directly in law.
Okay. Sir, we'll see.
Thank you. Because of that lower interest rate, did that shorten the time span of the lease? Because at 10-14, or is it just because we're another year? Why did that 2020 change on 10-14?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, that appears to have just been a mistake in when we drafted it. Because if you look at Section 9, the date was 2019. So 2019 is inclusive of the full 10-year repayment period.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, beginning on line 16 of page 10 is Section 4.
Mm-hmm.
Sections 4, 5, and 7 all implement the governor's recommendation regarding restructuring of the recycling program. Sections 4 and 5 authorize the Department of Administration to operate internal service funds related to recycling. Couple pages, Section 7 removes the recycling revenue from the general fund and requires it to be used to offset the costs of the recycling program. Moving on to Section 5 on page 11, that's part of the recycling recommendation that I just discussed. Section 6 on page 11. This is some cleanup language related to the Dewar merger. As a result of the merger, Dewar's WICRA, the Workers' Comp Reinsurance Association duties, were transferred to admin as well as the open appropriation for the WICRA premiums. However, the statutory language, instead of changing doer to admin, changed it to MMB, so this is just correcting that. On page 13 is section 7, and that's the last of the provisions that are related to the governor's recommendation related to recycling.
And Mr. Chair and members, section 8 is an item that is part of the discussion of cash flow that's been going on in various committees. And what this does is actually change the on line 18 there, the shall to may. And what this does is basically preserve the ability to delay aid payments to schools, preserve that as a tool for cash flow management for the state, but not make it required as a step before deciding to short-term borrow. So as our agency reads the statute right now, the shall makes it seem like we need to exhaust all tools that we have, including this one, to delay payments to school districts. And so this would convert it to a may so that we preserve the tool but still have the discretion to use it when advisable.
Sure. And although this budget division has jurisdiction over MMB, this does affect, obviously, other areas, which is within the umbrella of the Finance Committee. So, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, turning to the next page, Section 9 is that second part of the lease purchase appropriations modification. And Section 10 implements one of the governor's recommendations related to the Department of Revenue. This is the item that was expected to save about $78,000 per year by eliminating the need to process paper returns in this particular case, which is when a tax preparer prepares more than 10 returns, then they would need to do so electronically rather than on paper.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, sir, we'll see.
I need to go back to Section 8 to 13.18 in that shall and that may. I need to get more clarification there because I believe two of my school districts got hit really hard on money taken out of their reserves. Is that where this – I'm wondering if that's the area that this affects?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, yes, if you're referring to the plan to delay aid payments to schools for a few months in order to help with the state's cash flow situation, this is the statute under which that is done. If you're referring to the actual shifts, that is done under a different statute.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate you clarifying that, but there was also a third one where schools that had reserves, that money was taken. In two of my school districts, one a relatively small school district, $700,000 was taken out of their reserve fund, and another one $4.5 million. So this is just with the delayed payments. That doesn't affect when the governor took money from their reserves. This doesn't affect that. That was something else.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, to the extent that the state delays aid payments to schools, they would likely spend out of their reserves in order to maintain operations. If they, if that's how they're operating their funding. So this would likely be that provision.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, the reserves money weren't taken. It was just that if they had reserves, the payments were delayed until June. Mm-hmm. And under the law that was passed in the 80s, it's required to do that. So as I understand the testimony, now this would make it more permissive so they don't have to do it. Now the law requires them to delay those payments.
This is a good thing to give them the flexibility because it was also my understanding that some of the bond houses or the credit raters, said, yeah, you have to follow your law and use all those tools before you come to borrow from anybody else. And so if we don't have it in law, maybe they can't hold us to it. I don't know. If we decide that it's easier for us to do the borrowing than for the school districts to do the borrowing. And I think that's what this is trying to get at. And it would give them the flexibility to determine who it was less expensive for if they had to borrow.
Thanks for clarifying.
I do recall that there was some concerns from some people on the Section 10 on the tax preparers. Is there anybody who wants to be heard on any item within Article 2? As I say, they may not be here today on that particular one. I do remember some people raising some questions on it, but that was earlier. Okay. Anything else?
Can I just ask about the State Recycling Center?
Yeah, go ahead. We heard a little bit about it earlier. Go ahead.
Right. And this basically allows them to sell whatever they're recycling and get the money to help recover the costs of the program. But I'm wondering, when we talk about a center, is it an actual facility? I guess I wasn't really aware. Is it just the program that they're talking about and all of our efforts to recycle and move things through our regular collectors? Or do we have our own pickup? Or I didn't think we did.
Welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Fielding. I'm the Director of Plant Management, and the Resource Recovery Center is under my area of responsibility. We operate a facility down at our building down at 321 Grove Street. All of the recycled material is collected from around the Capitol campus and other outlying buildings. It's processed there, and that which can be sold is baled and hauled away, and revenue results from those sales. But we do have our own facility.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Roebling.
Have you been able to use the proceeds from that before to fund your center? Is this first giving you permission? And how close will it come to covering the costs of running the center?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, yes. Under the current arrangement, the operations expense is covered by a general fund appropriation. The revenue from sales of recycled material is used to offset that expense, and the budget is built on that net expense. However, the revenue, even in the best of times, has only accounted for about a third of the total operating expense. So it's a net cost to the state, and that would continue even in the arrangement that we have going forward. The distinction is that the source of funding to cover the expenses would be coming from direct billing as opposed to a general fund appropriation.
Sarah Loomer.
Direct billing to agencies?
Yes.
Sarah Loomer?
I didn't have a question on this particular recycling portion.
Anything else? Anything else on the recycling part?
I just want to
ask. Sarah Loomer.
Do you include an estimate in there when you say about a third of it comes from the sales of the recyclables? But would our garbage bills not be significantly higher if we had to put all of that through our regular trash collection?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, they would be, but under a new arrangement, that the process would not change. Whether the state continues to provide the service or whether through a competitive bid process it's performed by a third party, the specifications would be the same. So there will be no increase in material that's finding its way into the general waste disposal. And in fact, it's in our best interest, as it would be in the best interest of a third party, to maximize the recycling because of the revenue value.
Mr. Fielding, are the agencies going to be absorbing these costs then in doing this?
Mr. Chair, yes. The plan going forward is that the agencies would be billed, and those agencies that are in leased facilities, we would bill back through the landlord.
Okay, Sarah Pappas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that was Senator Roebling's question. I think the question was, if you put less into the garbage, into the waste stream, and your garbage bill is less, shouldn't you get some kind of credit for that, since you've saved on garbage bills costs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas and Senator Roebling, yes, absolutely. We pay a tip charge based upon the weight that's hauled down for general disposal, so it's in our best interest to maximize recycling and to minimize general waste, and we have done that this year. In particular, we're down over 10%.
Okay, any other questions on the recycling part?
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry.
Well, how do the agencies, if the whole, I don't know, it seems like kind of a balkanization of the system if you're going to charge the agencies for recycling, but then are you going to give them credit for reducing the amount of waste they produce?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, that would all be figured into the rates that we charge.
To the agency?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions on the recycling part? Okay. Sarah Loomer?
Thank you. I'd like to bring us back to the technology lease purchase appropriations. There's two sections. One's on page 14. The other one goes back to page 9 and 10. I noticed in both fiscal year appropriations, the lit column numbers, the first 2 years are rather modest in increase, and then in the third year, or fiscal year 2012, we bump the figures by about 300%, and then we keep them going for the remainder of that 19-year life. And I was just wondering why. Could you help me recall why we're putting that type of commitment in at such a large dollar amount?
Who feels that, Ms. Reed or Ms. Barondo?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I think I understand your first part of the question. I may need you to help me understand the second half. The first 2 years of the arrangement, fiscal year 2010 and fiscal year 2011, were structured so that we were paying mostly interest in those years rather than interest and principal. And that was partly part of a conversation with the committees during conference committee last year to try to make it a little more affordable in the near term. And that actually, in speaking with the Treasury Division, made some sense because that would be the development period of the systems, so we wouldn't start paying principal on those systems until later on during the 10-year period. If you could help me understand the second part of your question.
Well, Ms. Chair, I'm wondering, what are we getting? What's the bang for the buck for the 300% increase? Is it, are we getting new equipment? Are we, does this go into rental space? What are we spending our money for?
Ms. Reed.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, this is a 10-year spreading of the cost of two systems for state government. So the first one is the new accounting and procurement system. So that's the replacement. This is the debt service over the 10 years on that system. And then the second system was the integrated tax system at the Department of Revenue. So this is just spreading out the total cost over the 10 years in order to make it more affordable within the committee's target.
All right. Mr. Chair, the only thing I had a concern about is we know that next biennium we're going to be having difficulty once again with a much far serious deficit for the upcoming biennium, and who knows what's going to happen after that biennium of where we as a state are going to be. I'm just a little curious why we structured it with large numbers in the out years when we know that we may be in worse economic condition than we are now, and with a rather modest deficit this year, we went rather small with the payment structure. So I don't know if anyone can answer that in the room of why we arranged that payment schedule the way it was. Does anyone have any?
I don't know. Does
characterization
anybody?
Of that discussion?
I don't. This is not my proposal here. So,
all right.
Ms. Reed.
And Mr. Chair, members, that's part of the reason why this isn't a financing tool that one would want to use in all situations. This is a financing tool that made a lot of sense, though, in the situation of two systems that are very vital to the operation of state government. One system that is used to maintain all of our records related to accounting and procurement in the entire state. The other system that manages the entire revenue-generating process of the state. And so what you see here is the cost spread out over 10 years of two very vital systems. And MMB didn't make the recommendation for that financing lightly. Certainly, it was paired with the real imperative of having two functioning and state-of-the-art systems in that area.
Mr. Chair, I know that Senator Bonhoff had a bill last week that we heard that recognized IT infrastructure that it would be recognized and be eligible for bonding bills. And this is more of a direct appropriation, I believe, and we're putting it on a payment schedule, similar to a bonding bill, I suppose, but it's a commitment over 9 years. And I don't recall seeing a payment schedule like this too often in law. And I suppose this is one way to get around a big ticket item and then just recognize the payment structure in law. But
well, it actually is familiar. Mr. Lundeen, have we seen it before?
Well, we did talk about this last year. This was the governor's proposal and went through the process. And I think we discussed it more in the conference committee, and that's where we got additional information, as Ms. Reed said, paying the interest up front and than kind of the interest plus the principal in the later years. I think it helped to fit it into the target, and it made some sense from the way they wanted to finance it and the payments going out.
How we paid for SWIFT, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's kind of interesting with this style of legislating, and yet at the same time, we kind of pride ourselves on not committing our future legislators to our decisions that we make today. And yet, I don't know how you could avoid it because we're obligating the state on payment schedules now for 9 years.
Well, that was the only way we could pay for a set of maps, you know, is to do it. And that's what the administration came up with, saying that they could support doing something like that. There was no money, so that's how we paid for it. So, anything else on Article 2? Now, Article 3 actually is a policy area that is a bill that Senator Limmer has introduced, and since this is a budget division, I don't know that we really ought to be spending time going through that. I don't know what's going to happen in the policy committee, but I think, you know, we would need to have the policy committee review whether, you know, the concept of moving the implied consent hearings from the courts to the Office of Administrative Hearings before the budget division can really take any action on it. So,
Mr. Chairman, that's in the Judiciary Committee.
Yes,
Senator
Limmer has got a bill in the district. So I don't know that we really can spend much time on it until the policy committee's had their look at that one. So, okay, members, I think that most of what we've just heard in Article 2 is probably things that, you know, probably ought to be forwarded Finance Committee. Obviously, Article 1 doesn't apply because we've already done our budget provisions. Article 3 is the implied consent things, but I think a lot of the things in Article 2 are things that should be kept alive. Is there any issues that you see that we need to address or change or anything here in Article 2? So, well, since it's my bill, Sarah Olsen, can you take the gavel for a second? I'll move that Article 2 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Is there any discussion of opposition?
Okay, so Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, on in the Section 10 with regard to the tax refund return preparers, is the reference there solely to paid preparers? You know, the definition in 289A60, is that restricted to paid preparers?
Senator Pappas, what page are you on?
Well, I'm
going to
rest, but yeah,
sorry.
On page 14, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. That is a huge change down from 100 to 10.
Perhaps Ms. Reed can answer that one.
Mr. Chair, members, unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that. I would need to check with the Department of Revenue to be sure, and we can ask them to get back to the committee.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, we can check. We don't need to check them. Sir, just check the statute.
Unless you're a paid preparer, I don't think you have to sign the tax returns. You know, like if I help my children with theirs, I don't have to sign them unless I'm paid for that service. So it would, I think it would have to be a paid preparer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's referenced in 289A60, so what is the definition?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, basically there's a longer definition, but it requires that, or it says that the term tax refund or return preparer means an individual who prepares for compensation or who employs other individuals to prepare for compensation.
Okay, any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Wimmer.
Mr. Chair, in this particular discussion, have we talked to anyone in the industry? Do they have an opinion on it? Have the CPA groups given us any idea of what would work in their industry?
Senator Betzel, do you have any response?
You know, I remember some discussion on it, and I'm just drawing a blank right now. Somebody had raised some concerns about that. And I don't remember, it was you.
Yeah.
Was that when we went through the governor's initial budget sheets? Obviously, if this bill goes forward, it'll be looked at the Finance Committee, and I don't know whether it needs to be then possibly referred to the Tax Committee for their review as well, too. I'm not sure. So, but I don't think we've got people here in this room who can fully explain, you know, all the pros and cons to this particular point.
Okay, any further discussion? Yeah. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bethelt, your motion kind of confused me when you said to just send Article 2. Does that mean you're sending Senate File 3134, but it only is going to include Article 2?
That's correct.
Okay, then I think...
Not Article 1, not Article 3.
So, okay, that was, yeah.
Just move Article 2.
So delete the rest of
the bill. Yeah, delete Article 1, delete Article 3, just forward Article 2 of Senate File 3134.
Okay, and then I just want to make a comment. My husband does do taxes for friends and family. He does get paid for it, but I can't imagine him not doing it electronically. I just think that is, for most of these, that's just so much easier. That I'd be very, very surprised that anybody who would do 10 tax returns, whether they're just doing it, you know, and he gets paid for it, would not do it electronically.
I mean, although
I just can't imagine, you
know,
it.
Mr. Chair, and Senator,
it's the electronic
Pappas.
World, you know.
Yeah.
Print them.
I mean, it's been a few years since I was on the tax committee, but I do remember the issue coming on up as the Department of Revenue was trying to get more people to file electronically, and it's happening. I mean, most of the returns are electronic. But you still have those old tax preparers out there that still want to do it the old-fashioned way, and they do it, you know, by, you know, paper. It's a dying breed, but I think those people are still out there somewhere. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Rest.
It fences those folks, the small preparers, if you will, out. I'm sure the CPA Society would be very supportive of this because it means that some of those taxpayers could no longer go to their, quote, old-time tax preparer, and they'd have to go to a...
somebody who actually knows the latest.
They'd have to get,
rules.
You know, go to a service. Moving from 100 to 10, I think that's very controversial.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I mean, we could change it to 20 or something. Probably those old-time tax preparers don't do more than...
Thing, but I'm just raising the issue.
Don't have that many customers still alive.
Any further discussion on Senate File 3134?
I just want to say one more thing.
Senator
Pappas. My mother had one of those old-time tax preparers, and he royally screwed up her taxes. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Senator Rest.
Senator Pappas, I don't file my clients electronically, and I don't screw up the returns.
And how many clients do you have?
They actually have under 10.
There you go.
But what if I had 11?
Okay. With any further discussion on Senate File 3134,
sorry,
Article
Chair.
2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Anything else that anybody wants to bring before us today? Thank you. Wednesday, Senator Roebling, you've got two bills up, Senate File 2858, that's state agency deposit receipts amount requirements, and then state-owned buildings disposal process. And then I'm going to have the state webmaster bill up on Wednesday. So, okay, if nothing further, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.